no doubt will agree, this world is our home, not your property, it's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you see these things our taxes paid for.
Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy, a program that explores issues of community democracy and what we the people are doing to create a sustainable democratic alternative to corporate control. From the Philo Studio, I'm your host, Linda McClure. Support for Corporations and Democracy come from the listeners who step up to become members and provide financial support. And Sonoma Clean Power, the official energy supplier for Sonoma County and now Mendocino County. Now Mendocino County residents also have a locally controlled energy choice for home or business that reduces greenhouse gases. Additional information at sonomacleanpower.org/Mendocino County. The views expressed on this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the opinions of station staff, members, or board. If you call in when the listener phone line is opened, please be aware that the show is recorded and may be accessed at KZYX&Z's website archives or played at a later date. We'll open the listener phone lines about 1:30, and you're welcome to join the conversation. The number at the Philo Studio is 895-2448. Our guest today is Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, author, lecturer, global political and social justice activist, and one gutsy lady. You see her regularly on Democracy Now!, raising her voice on the street or in the halls of Congress and being led away by uniformed men. President Barack Obama once said of Medea Benjamin, "That woman is worth paying attention to." Welcome to the show, Medea. Thanks so much for giving us this time.
Thanks so much for having me on, Linda.
And so what did you do or say to get President Obama's attention?
Well, that was when he was giving his major foreign policy address at the National Defense Institute. And I can't tell you how, but I did manage to get in there. And I was waiting. He was supposed to be announcing new policies around both the use of drone warfare and Guantanamo. And towards the end of his speech, I realized he hadn't done either, at which time I got up and I spoke out about how can a constitutional lawyer condone indefinite detention in Guantanamo. I spoke on behalf of drone victims whose loved ones had been killed. And I kept the conversation going for quite a while, despite the fact that the police and the FBI and the Secret Service were immediately all over me, telling me I was being arrested. I said, "Well, wait, you can't arrest me right now. I'm in the middle of a conversation with the president."
and they waited, I'll bet. Huh?
They waited. They were kind of stunned, like, uh-oh. In fact, I said to one of them, "Shh, one, I can't hear, and two, you're going to get in trouble if you arrest me while I'm talking to him." So I bought a little time, not too much, but it helps.
So you're a committed and respected global activist and an incredibly productive person. When in your life were you awakened to social disparities and the consequences and injustices?
You know, I look today at young people and many of us in the older generation say, you know, why aren't they involved in the anti-war movement? Well, you know, there's one word to that, and that's the draft. And when I was in high school, during the draft, my friends were getting shipped off to Vietnam and coming home in body bags. And my sister's boyfriend was shipped over to Vietnam and started sending her, sent her an ear of a Viet Cong to wear as a souvenir. and became went from this lovely young head of the football team to a monster killer. So it was out of necessity that many of us started getting involved in the anti-war movement around Vietnam. And so I'd say I'm an anti-war activist ever since. There were periods of my life where I focused on other issues, more on the economic justice part of things, sweatshops, fair trade. But at the heart of my activism has always been the sense of don't let governments fool you into thinking that entire countries and people are our enemy.
Yeah, the Vietnam War opened a lot of eyes. And you received a master's degree in public health from Columbia University. Where were you in your life? And where were you focusing your energies at that time?
I had dropped out of college thinking that it was more important to be an activist and see the world than it was to sit in a classroom. So it was after a number of years of living in Africa and Latin America that I realized I wanted to have a skill to contribute. And so I went back to get a master's degree in public health nutrition, and then I started working for the United Nations at the Food and Agriculture Organization. But in doing that, I found that, one, it was the UN is so bureaucratic, and two, that the problems were really political ones, that there was enough food to go around, it was a question of distribution. And so I went back to school and got another degree in political economy and then turned back to activism.
Right. So that was why your second master's degree was in economics, because how did that mesh with public health?
Well, the public health is great, and I have tremendous respect for people who work in the public health field. But to me, it felt like I was putting a Band-Aid on this gaping wound, and I wanted to go deeper and realize that so many of the ills, whether it was the poverty I encountered or the environmental destruction or the issues of whipping up racist discrimination or religious hatred, that if you look behind it, it was a lot about economic interests. And as your program rightly focuses so much on corporations and corporate ills, I found that so stark when I worked overseas and would see different corporations and how manipulative they were of the local populations because they were just concerned about making money and not concerned about people's lives.
And you've authored many articles and 12 books, if I've counted them all, starting in 1984 with No Free Lunch, Food and Revolution in Cuba Today. This year you had published Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So let's talk about Iran. What led you to write this book?
Well, it kind of was an outgrowth, Linda, of the last book I wrote, which was about Saudi Arabia. And people often ask, well, why did you write about Saudi Arabia? And then I say, well, it's an outgrowth of the work that I and Cook Pink have been doing on Israel-Palestine. I would always get confronted by people, especially in the Jewish community, saying, why do you just focus on Israel-Palestine? What about all these repressive Arab regimes? And so I took them seriously and started looking at Saudi Arabia and became appalled at how the U.S. was so cozy with one of the most repressive regimes in the world. And then as I did the work on Saudi Arabia, I would often get asked, well, what about Iran? And so I felt it was important to learn more about Iran, especially since it seemed like with Donald Trump running for office and all of his rhetoric at the time that has unfortunately come to fruition about wanting to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, that it was important for Americans, and especially Americans in the progressive community, to have a better understanding about what Iran is like, in order to inform us about what kind of U.S. policies we should have towards Iran.
And what are your main points? What is Iran like? I mean, that's a big question.
Yes. Well, it's a big question, but I'll try to break it down. There is a government in power that is run by a theocracy that has a supreme leader with way too much power. Yet, on the other hand, there are democratic elements within the government, such as a very vibrant election system, even though those who can run for office are restricted by the religious clerics. There still are different factions, and it matters what faction wins. There are elements of civil society in Iran that are either allowed to function when there's a more relaxed atmosphere in the country and are cracked down on when conservatives are in power or things are tense with the Western world. So that's important to understand when looking at where should we position ourselves. The U.S. government has unfortunately taken the line of the Israelis and Saudi Arabia that Iran is an existential threat to the United States, which is absurd. It is not. And has, ever since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, had a very hostile relationship to Iran, including sanctions that have been in effect for decades now in one form or another. And the U.S. is always hoping that the Iranian government will be overthrown, whereas most of the people that I am in touch with in Iran who don't like their government really want to see the government change, but want to see it from within, not from a push by outside powers, especially not the United States.
And why do you see the United States as being so focused on Iran? What is it about Iran that scares the United States? Or that interests
that
if not
at
scared.
A certain time in Iran's history, Iran was a close ally of the United States, and that was during the time of the Shah and his son. This was a dynasty that ruled Iran with an iron fist, extremely repressive and corrupt, and yet was a great ally because the regime under those time were open to the West and allowed Western companies to have major concessions, including the most important resource for Iran, which is oil. It was when the Iranians, in a democratic fashion, voted in a president in 1951, a prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, on a platform to nationalize the Iranian oil, something that was extremely popular. That's when the U.S. came in with the pushing of the British to overthrow that democratically elected government in 1953. And that, you can say, is the source of many evils since then, because the Iranians then organized for decades to try to get rid of the Shah. And when they finally did, the regime that came to power was not only anti-Shah, but was anti-American. You might recall, or your listeners might recall, the very long hostage crisis that happened in 1979, where Iranian students took 52 Americans and held them hostage at the U.S. Embassy for 444 days.
Right.
Well, when the hostage crisis happened, the U.S. broke relations with Iran, and those relations have never been restored. So a lot of the animosity stems from the time of the revolution, but it really goes back to the very nefarious role that the U.S. has played in modern Iranian history.
And what is the state of Iran today? When was the last time you were there?
The last time I was there was in 2015, so 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there three times in the last 10 years. It's a very tense situation because of the economy, especially in the last 6 months, where the value of the Iranian currency, the rial, has plummeted by half. Imagine if suddenly the U.S. dollar was worth half of what its value was, the American people would be going nuts. This is why there was protests at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, and why just yesterday, and I don't know what happened today, but there were quite large protests in Tehran yesterday over the economy. The economy is being squeezed by the U.S. and we can go into what is happening around the Iran nuclear deal because it's very much related to the economy. But there is a lot of discontent inside Iran today, mainly for economic issues, but also I do want to recognize that it's not all about being squeezed from the outside. There's also tremendous corruption inside Iran and small groups that are groups like the Revolutionary Guards or the clerics control a lot of the economy, and that contributes to the economic crisis.
So there are major hotspots in the world today, all over the world. What is your analysis of what's happening in Korea? Is Trump being brilliant? What other factors are there to consider?
Well, before we jump to Korea, I just did want to add on Iran.
Sure.
That the Iran nuclear deal that Trump pulled the U.S. out of is on life support right now. The other signatories, France, Germany, the U.K., Russia, and China are all staying in the deal, but Iran is not feeling the economic benefits that it was supposed to get as a result of this deal. And so there's a lot of pressure inside Iran from the conservatives to pull Iran out of the nuclear deal, which could lead to a greater push by Israel to get the United States to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. So I just want your listeners to know that we're in a very dangerous position right now, thanks to Donald Trump, and that people who care about whether the United States gets involved in yet another truly catastrophic war should be pressuring your elected officials to reiterate that Donald Trump does not have the authority to intervene militarily in Iran. That authority rests with Congress, and we don't want to go to war with Iran. And that would move me to your next question about North Korea, because that was the other really hot spot, I would say, Iran and North Korea, especially because North Korea does have nuclear weapons, unlike Iran, which does not have nuclear weapons. So in the case of North Korea, we were really on a collision course when Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un from North Korea were trading very sharp barbs with each other. And people on the Korean Peninsula were really worried that this was going to lead to either a conventional war that would lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths or a nuclear war that would lead to millions of deaths. So the fact that the summit actually took place is a very positive thing. And I get quite annoyed with people who want to criticize everything that Trump does. And there's certainly a pretty endless list of things we can name. But when he does something good, I think we should applaud him for that. And that is the summit. On the other hand, because he's so erratic, we don't know whether he's going to continue with this. And so we should build up pressure to say that the getting towards a peace treaty on the Korean Peninsula would be a really marvelous thing for the 75 million people who live on that peninsula.
And are the war games that were so felt so threatening to North Korea, are those, I know he's cut back, do you know if they're stopping completely?
Well, they're on hold, which is a really positive thing, something that the North Korean government has called for a long time.
Right.
It's quite interesting to hear Donald Trump say that those war exercises were, quote, provocative, because they are extremely provocative. They're about decapitation of the leadership. They're about taking over the North. And it's a positive thing that they have been put on hold. We have to look at how North Korea already, without even before the summit happened, had released U.S. prisoners, had blown up one of their nuclear testing sites, and had agreed not to continue testing nuclear weapons or its ballistic missiles. So that was quite a lot of concessions that the North Koreans had made. So I think it's totally appropriate that President Trump said he was putting those military exercises that the U.S. does with South Korea, putting them on hold.
So let's go back to the Middle East a bit. The U.S. government has aligned our country with Saudi Arabia in their brutal attack of Yemen. What interest do the Saudis and the U.S. have in Yemen?
The Saudis saw the uprising of a local group called the Houthis as a concern for them because the Houthis are a tribe that practices a religion that's close to the Shia religion, and they were worried that if the Houthis got control, Iran would have a friendly government on its doorstep. And so they also, out of hubris, the young Crown Prince Salman, at that time just 30 years old, became the head of defense. And he thought that this would be a quick and dirty thing to just go in there, crush the Houthis, and bring their preferred leader back in power. That is now 3 years since that happened, and obviously it was a miscalculation on the part of the Saudis, and they've dug in deeper and deeper. The Crown Prince is an incredibly rash and arrogant young man, and he doesn't want to have this as a loss. So he just digs in, and now the fighting has gone to the port of Hodeidah, which is where the majority of the humanitarian and commercial supplies come in, as well as the fuel. So there is a tremendous scramble right now at the United Nations to try to stop the fighting at the port and to put that port under UN control. If it doesn't happen, the already catastrophic situation in Yemen, where a child dies every 10 minutes from the effects of this war, will get massively worse.
And why has the U.S. aligned itself with Saudi Arabia? As we know that the vast majority of the hijackers from 911 were from Saudi Arabia. Yet the U.S. has always always aligned ourselves with Saudi Arabia. Why is that?
Two words: oil and money. Oil from the 1938 on, when oil was first discovered in Saudi Arabia, the U.S. wanted to make sure that its companies were getting rich off of that and having some control over where that oil would go. And the other was all the profits that came from the oil. The Saudi government, and remember, this is just one family that's been ruling since 1932, but they were very clever in making sure that a lot of the petrodollars were recycled back into the United States. And so you see in all kinds of areas in the U.S. The Saudi influence. Saudis put money into many of the major stock exchange companies, into U.S. Treasury bonds. They're heavily invested in the high-tech industry. They invested billions of dollars in Uber, for example. They have put a lot of money into think tanks to spread a positive message about Saudi Arabia. They've hired about two dozen PR and law firms to give the spin that Saudi Arabia is a great reformist ally. And they have given money to Ivy League universities. They are very clever about the way they spread their wealth to have deep ties in the United States. The oil ties, for example, go as far as them now owning the largest refinery in Texas. So there, scratch the surface of many things and you will find Saudi money behind it, which means there are a lot of intertwined interests that keep the U.S., and especially in an administration like Donald Trump, where so much of it is that he's the salesperson for the United States, it's about money. And one other industry I think is the largest one I forgot to mention is the weapons industry, where the Saudis have become, under Obama, the largest purchaser of U.S. weapons. And this is an industry that has tremendous lobby, that gives money to almost every single one of our congresspeople, that says that the industry is about jobs instead of saying that it's about killing people. But these are the kind of ties that unfortunately have bound us to this very repressive regime of Saudi Arabia. And it's the reason why the U.S. has so much blood on its hands when it comes to Yemen, because these are our weapons that are being used. The U.S. is maintaining the fleet. It's giving logistical support. It's refueling the airplanes that are bombing the Yemenis. It's really, Saudi Arabia could not carry out its war on Yemen were it not for U.S. support.
It is going on 1:26. Our guest today is Medea Benjamin. She's co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, author, lecturer, global political and social justice activist. We're going to be opening the phone lines in a few minutes, so if you'd like to make comments, ask questions, the number here in the studio is 895-2448. So let's see, we've talked some about the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, Iran, Yemen. What other dynamics are going on in the Middle East that you think are particularly relevant?
Well, I did want to mention one campaign that Code Pink is involved in, if that's okay.
Sure, absolutely.
It spans the Middle East and everywhere, which is a campaign called Divest from the War Machine. And we talked about how the Middle East conflicts have been going on now for decades, and one thing that they have in common is that they're making the weapons manufacturers extremely wealthy. So we have a campaign now that has many different facets to it. I think it's really exciting, and I love the way that it's developing, which is one aspect is a new fund that we released today. It's called the Weapons Free Fund, and it's a database where you can look up any investment fund and see how much of it, if any, is invested in the weapons industry. That's either civilian weapons, military weapons, and then use that as a tool when you go to your city council or your pension fund or your university and say, I want them to make a commitment to not invest in the weapons industry. You probably know, Linda, this has been done very successfully. People working around fossil fuels. There's a campaign to divest from the private prison industry. There's a campaign around Israeli products. So this is following in the footsteps of other organizers who have done great work, and we're very excited that now we have the database available so that anybody could see what is a way that that communities can invest that is free from the merchants of death, as the Pope calls them.
Yeah, the Pope has been quite outspoken, and it's refreshing.
Yes, and another aspect to this campaign, Linda, is that we're asking members of Congress to commit to not taking money from either the NRA or the top five weapons manufacturers, because every year they are voting on the Pentagon budget, and half that budget goes back to the weapons manufacturers. They're also voting on all kinds of things that affect the bottom line of these military contractors. So we feel it's a major conflict of interest and that they should agree to stop taking money from them.
And the movement, the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement that you're working with, what kind of things are you looking at boycotting?
Well, the BDS movement refers particularly to Israel. The divestment that I'm talking about is about U.S. companies that are the major producers of weapons. As far as the BDS movement around Israel, We as Code Pink are part of a much larger movement, a global movement, and we have taken certain companies, for example, right now we are working on Remax, the real estate agent, because they are selling homes in illegal settlements, and we want to convince them that they should stop including settlements in the list of places where they are active. So that's one of the campaigns. We've had successful campaigns in the past against companies like the cosmetic company called Ahava, against SodaStream for producing it, for having a factory in a legal settlement. So the BDS movement is a way that people can get involved as consumers to show or companies where they want, where we want our dollars spent, where we don't, and to push them to take more ethical stands.
What kind of success have you been having with that?
Well, I mentioned we had a success with the cosmetic company, which is quite large. We had a success with SodaStream. There have been successes with very large companies like Veolia, because the Europeans have been involved in this campaign, and they have managed to get their companies to their countries to stop doing business with some of these very large Israeli companies. There's also a cultural boycott dynamic of this, and the BDS movement has been very successful in getting important cultural icons to cancel trips to Israel, to agree to not play in concerts, to all kinds of things. Some of the superstars of this movement have been people like Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, Lauryn Hill, Chuck D, and we have had some interesting campaigns where the artists had no idea what they were getting themselves into in agreeing to do a concert, and then realizing, uh-oh, you know, this is a can of worms I didn't understand. And so quite a number of them have been canceling.
Yeah, the celebrities, both movie, music, and sports celebrities, have really been making a difference these days. So you've led delegations to hotspots all over the world. You have gone to Gaza 7 times, I think. What benefit do these delegations provide?
We can't get in anymore, which was very unfortunate, because we got in through Egypt. Since the Israelis would never let us in, the only other way was through Egypt. And once the coup happened that kicked the Muslim Brotherhood leader, President Morsi, out of power, we can't go in anymore. There's also a lot of fighting happening in the Sinai, and it's become very dangerous. So it's unfortunate. It's become harder to get in, and pretty much impossible to take delegations. When we did take them, it was extremely important, because we took in some very large delegations, 100 people, 150 people from all walks of life, and managed to get many different people-to-people kind of ties started up. And, of course, eye-opening for the people in the delegations that would then go back and work in their churches or in their universities to get support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, or to get to put pressure on their elected officials. There's nothing like going there to make people feel committed. And I look back on some of the results of those trips and see entire projects. Like, one is called We Are Not Numbers, and it's a wonderful website that your listeners could go to, because it's a woman who decided to work with the youth in Gaza and help them with their English. So so she paired them up with writers in the United States, and each one got a mentor. And then they would do stories. They've done incredible videos, all kinds of cultural manifestations to show that the people of Gaza are human beings just like us, perhaps more creative because they have to be. And that's an example of the kind of things that come out of these delegations.
What unexpected problems have you had on these delegations?
Well, there's the unfortunate, but oftentimes problems of people getting sick. There are problems in the case of going to Gaza, for example, of government trying to tell you where you can go and where you can't go, Hamas particularly. There's a problem in Israel where we get shut down and sometimes even deported just from the airport. There's problems in Egypt where I got beat up in the airport and my shoulder dislocated by government thugs. There's problems in Pakistan where we were told by the U.S. Embassy that we were going to be targeted by the Taliban. So we certainly face problems, not every time, but in a lot of times in these delegations, because we're going to dangerous places. But we try to be very careful about how we go about doing this, about the people we bring. And right now, we're trying to get permission from the Iranian government to bring 100 people from Europe and the United States in a peace walk and a gathering that would be looking at the ways we can promote civil society inside Iran and support peaceful policies back in our home countries.
So you're listening to KZYX and Z. I'm your host, Linda McClure. Our guest is Medea Benjamin. And if you'd like to call and make comment or ask a question, the number is 895-2448. So what is the most dangerous situation you found yourself in? It sounds like the being beaten up in the airport was pretty intense.
Well, that was terrible because I still suffer the consequences from it today. I had to have a shoulder operation, and my shoulder will never be the same again. So I do get a lot of pain from that, and it's been several years now. Uh-huh. But in terms of fearing for my life, I would say the most dangerous was in Pakistan, where it was just two of us, and we were there supporting the journalists who had been striking for more free press and the lawyers as well. And in the process of showing solidarity with them, we were kidnapped by 12 armed men and driven down the roads in Lahore at about 100 miles an hour, and then taken to a very secretive police station where we were interrogated for a long time, and in the end got deported. But that was quite a scary situation.
It would be, yeah. So how is community organizing different in other countries than it is in the United States when you're working with community groups?
Well, it depends, you know, so much on how the government is and how if there's an openness, let's take South Korea, for example. It's gone through periods where activism around peace was considered a national security threat and people were thrown in prison for long periods of time. There's a openness now, and you see just a tremendous outpouring of activism, and much more radical than a lot of the activism in the United States. They can get away with more, in a sense, in terms of confronting the police, having physical exchanges with the police. They don't get shot like people do here. There's a lot of very, very creative activism that I am so inspired by. when I go to a place like South Korea. On the other hand, you go somewhere like Iran, and it's semi-clandestine. So you have to be very careful about who you're meeting with and where you're meeting and what you publicize about it, because you don't want to get the activists in trouble. The same would be for the Saudis, who are even just human rights lawyers, constantly under threat. And even when the announcement was made that Saudi women would gain the right to drive, something the activists in Saudi Arabia had been working for decades, about a dozen of those very activists were thrown in jail and are still in jail right now. So it is so dependent on what government is in power and how much space there is for people to organize.
So let's go back to some organizations that you founded. You started, you co-founded Global Exchange. What was that? Was back in what year? In the 80s? 90s?
Yes, that was in the late 80s.
Uh-huh.
And the whole idea came from having had a chance to travel around the world. And, you know, when you get outside the U.S., you learn more about the U.S. sometimes than you do when you're inside.
Right.
You know, you see your own country in a different light. And I, with two colleagues, thought it was so important that we give Americans more opportunities to see other places around the world. So we started Global Exchange with these reality tours that have gone all over the world, and Global Exchange continues to organize these trips today. In fact, they have a trip going to Iran in September that people can find out about by going to their website, globalexchange.org. And the other thing we did was to bring the fair trade label to the United States and promote the whole idea of fair trade, get coffee and tea and bananas, and work with groups that wanted to bring that fair trade label into the stores and cafes and companies around the U.S. So that was a very successful campaign. And then we worked on the sweatshop issues, trying to stop U.S. companies from the super exploitation of workers overseas. We brought about 17 companies to legal suits against them for abuse of workers overseas who were not being paid their overtime, not being paid even the minimum wage. And we worked on getting Starbucks to carry fair trade coffee. So, and then one other thing, we worked with a wonderful and broad coalition of groups against the World Bank and the IMF, and we were part of the shutting down of the IMF when it met in Seattle. And so those are some of the very exciting things that we've been involved in.
Yeah. And how about Code Pink? How did that get? What was the inspiration?
Yeah, it was right after the 9/11 attacks, where some of us knew that the response of the United States was not going to be, let's find who attacked us and bring them to justice, but was going to be, let's use this as an excuse to do all kinds of things we had wanted to do, such as overthrowing Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Of course, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right.
So we formed Code Pink as part of the incredible mobilizing that went on throughout the United States and the world, I must say, in the wake of 9/11 to try to stop the invasion of Iraq. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do that, but Code Pink ever since has been trying to stop U.S. military interventions overseas, stop the incredibly bloated Pentagon budget, and instead use more of our funds to support efforts at home and abroad to deal with poverty, climate chaos, and the kind of issues that affect people's everyday life.
And it was the different coding systems that we had, the reason that that you're pink, you're Code Pink. I know there was the Code Yellow and Code Orange and Code Red, and we were
that's right, that crazy George Bush color coding system that people didn't know what the heck he was talking about and what the heck they were supposed to do if the color code changed. But yes, we did want to be code hot pink. we thought that would be a lot cooler than just code pink, but it was URL was already taken by a porn company, so we had to just be code pink.
Uh-huh. So you were a candidate for U.S. Senate in 1999. What do you think can be accomplished within Congress by people who are elected that can't be done in the streets?
Well, I'm quite cynical about Congress because I'm here all the time. In fact, as we speak, I'm in the cafeteria of the Rayburn Building in Congress. And yet, I am so appreciative of those few who come into Congress and really want to work with the grassroots and want to bring their more progressive, radical, sometimes, values into these very conservative halls. So I look at somebody like Pramila Jayapal from Seattle,
yeah,
a new congressperson, and she's a rock star. She's amazing. She's leading a big demonstration tomorrow with women who are coming in from all over and going to do a radical blockade of some of the worst enforcers of Trump's immigration policy of separating families. So you see people like her once in a while, or Ro Khanna, who is from California as well, from Silicon Valley, and some of us had grave doubts and thought, well, he's going to be in the pockets of the IT companies. And instead, he's been our best champion to try to stop the U.S. from supporting the Saudis in Yemen, for example, and all kinds of other issues around foreign policy. So those are two examples of new Congress people who have really shaken things up in Congress. And if we had a dozen of them, we could do heck of a lot to change things here.
Right, yeah. This election year has been pretty interesting. 895-2448. We had a couple calls, but they didn't stay on. And so callers, do call back, and we'll get you picked up. I don't want to get started on a conversation and have the callers come in again, but I'll go ahead and do that. Do you still have aspirations to run? Oh, we've got a call. Hold on. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for having this conversation. In recent years, I've come to the conclusion that the economic force of the military-industrial complex is our biggest problem. And one of the experiences I had was a couple of years ago, I was online, and I found a website that showed the amount of money that our Congress people had invested in the military-industrial complex. And it was interesting because the website didn't stick around. It was only there for a couple of times. And it was surprising. I think John Kerry was Secretary of State at that time, and he had $32 million invested in the military-industrial complex. So I'm wondering if you're... And, of course, the point being is they have a conflict of interest. They're making money by going to war. And so they're not, you know, they're in a position where if they vote against war, it costs them money. And so I'm wondering, are you working with Congress people to divest their investments in the military-industrial complex? Thanks. I'll listen on the air.
Thanks so much.
Well, that's interesting. It's even harder than what we're doing, which is asking them to not take money from the weapons industry, because at least there we can track things because of the website called Open Secrets. And if your listeners are interested, they should open it up, because you can look on a number of industries like the oil industry, pharmaceuticals, and you can see who are the top recipients in Congress. And so what the caller suggested about investments, those are private. We're not going to be able to know them. Look, the president, we couldn't even get to disclose his tax return. So how are we going to get that information? I think right now we want to focus on the issues about not taking money. But if you ever do come across that information or that website, please pass it on to us because it would be very interesting.
Okay. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello, this is Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Beautiful day. I'm interested in the portion of our national product that is war-related. I thought maybe Medea would have that on the top of her hat. Thank you.
Thanks. So, yeah, how much of our gross national product is related to war?
Well, we talk about it more in terms of how much of the discretionary budget, meaning the budget that Congress gets to allocate, is related to war. And there you see that it's about 60%, which is, you know, just enormous when you look at all the other needs for education and healthcare and transportation and dealing with the climate issues. The lion's share of the discretionary budget goes to the military. And this is something that Donald Trump is trying to push overseas, trying to get the other NATO countries to spend more of their nation's wealth on the military, trying to get the South Koreans to pay more for their military. It's quite remarkable how he's become a salesperson for the U.S. weapons industry. But your caller is right in bringing up the enormous, the bloated Pentagon budget, and how little it is talked about in terms of what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about in 1961 when he was leaving the presidency. And remember, he was a general.
And a Republican.
The stealing of our money going into bombs and tanks that could be going into things like education and health care. So we're one of the few groups that every year is trying to push our Congress people to not be okaying this enormous Pentagon budget. I wish it's something that Bernie Sanders had talked about more when he was running for office, because I think that was the perfect time to educate people about where we could get the money for free college education, where we could get the money for a Medicare for All health system. It would be by dramatic cuts in the military budget. And also, let's remember that most of that budget is going to the weapons industry, and it's not going for our defense. It's going really for our offense, which is making us less safe in the world.
Mm-hmm. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Should I wait till she's done talking?
No, she's calling from the Senate cafeteria or the congressional cafeteria, so there's background noise.
Okay.
So, okay, go ahead.
Ask Medea something that's unrelated to some of the conversation, but has haunted me. Is I was curious about the work Marla Ruzicka did. Every year I think about her and the work she did. I live in an area close by, and was wondering if the policies that she got passed in Congress are they actually following through and paying the money out to people who were affected by our bombing, or did they let that legislation just kind of fade away? And I just want her to know that I'm grateful. I heard her at the passage of Marla, and it was a very powerful experience, so I think about her often. Anyway, I'm curious if the work she did is actually being followed through on.
Thank you.
So for listeners who don't know what the caller is talking about, Marla Ruzicka was an extraordinary young woman. She was like a daughter to me, came to live with me at age 16. I continue to be very close to her family. In fact, I just saw her twin brother and his family a couple of days ago.
Yeah, they live in Lake County.
Yes. And she worked to get compensation for the victims, innocent victims of U.S. interventions, first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And unfortunately, tremendous tragedy. She was blown up by an IED in Iraq. The organization that she founded, Civic, continues today. In fact, there was recently some more money was put into that fund called the Marla Ruzicka Fund for compensation. So there are people who are getting money years later thanks to Marla's work. Let's put it in the context of the military budget of about $1 trillion if you put everything together versus a fund that this year I think got $10 million. It is a drop in the bucket, should be much more, but it wouldn't be anything if it hadn't been for Marla's work.
So you just keep going and doing, and how do you keep yourself energized? What have you learned over the years of your activism?
I think what I learned is to surround yourself with positive people who are not just going to complain about how awful things are, but are going to look for solutions and be active. And that's both people in your small community as well as people on a larger stage who are folks that you can learn from. For example, I was just in Korea with a fantastic delegation of women, and it just being with that group of 30 women, including Nobel Peace Prize winners and ordinary activists and all kinds of women, you just learn so much from each other. So I would say it's really about building community.
Mm-hmm. And do you still have aspirations to hold political office?
I don't, because I see how corrupted the system is. I don't live in a place now. I mean, I live in D.C. and we don't even have representation here. So I don't myself want to run for office, but I do want to support people with similar politics who do.
Yeah. And what do you, we've got elections coming up. We just have a couple more minutes. We have elections, well, we've had primaries regularly. Is there anything that's surprising you or confirming what you already suspected in these primary elections?
Well, I think maybe it's different for your listeners, but I find oftentimes as I travel around that unfortunately we tend to live in our own bubbles and think that because there's so much anti-Trump sentiment among the people that we tend to hang out with, that that is the way the country is. And it's important to get out and talk to other people, Trump supporters, people who might be wondering if they should continue to be Trump supporters, Republicans who are wondering should they continue to be Republicans. There's a lot of people questioning their the system right now, and I think we've made mistakes in the past by not reaching out to people who don't think too much like us. And so I see, I'm worried that there's too much confidence that the Democrats will take back the House, too much confidence that there's going to be a real blowback against Trump. I hope that's the case, but I don't think we should be complacent. And also, what Democrats? I mean, we want Democrats who are, at least I do, who are more in the Bernie camp so that we can get some real changes, not just corporate Democrats who are going to keep things pretty much the same.
Right. So how can people get a hold of your organization, see what you're doing? What contact information can you give us?
They can go onto the website, which is codepink.org. I think it's also important to say that we have an activist house in Washington, D.C., and throughout the year, people come from around the country for a week at a time to join us in the halls of Congress, go lobby their congressperson, join us in the solidarity actions we do with lots of other movements. And so they can write to info@codepink.org to find out if there's room at the house when they might want to come. We also have weekly alerts that give people an idea of things they could do, so it's important to sign up for those. And also take a look at the new website called divestfromwarmachine.org.
Great. Well, Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for everything that you do and for making time for us today on Corporations and Democracy.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on, Linda.
Wish you the best of luck.
Thanks.
Bye now.
This world is our home, not your property. It's the kind.